I think a lot of the prejudice that we see and a lot of the inflexibility we see with older people will naturally be taken care of just by the fact that younger people, it seems to me, are used to living in a more diverse world, probably because media is part of it and they can have interactions with people in other places around the globe much more easily than their parents did. I think also that I see a little bit more of a spirit in younger people that I'm really happy to see in just a more of a desire to make a difference in the world, have their work make a difference, not just be a place that you go and get a paycheck.
Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a vodcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. If you're new to our channel, please consider subscribing to it and hit the bell icon so that you don't miss any updates. I am your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I am privileged to welcome a very, very accomplished individual from Anchorage, Alaska, USA, Diane Kaplan. Diane, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. It's terrific to be here.
Thank you. Diane is the president and CEO of the Rasmussen Foundation in Anchorage, Alaska. She has worked with several native corporations and tribes. She sits on several boards and she has been recognized and awarded globally. So Diane, let's talk about the Rasmussen Foundation. Tell me about the scope of work you handle.
I'd be happy to. Alaska is the largest state in area, 2.5 times Texas. We have about half the coastline in the entire United States, but only about 700,000 people spread across that land. So we are a very unique part of the landscape in the U.S. We were one of the last two states to join the Union in the late 1950s. So a lot of our history is tied up with the indigenous population who's been here for thousands and thousands of years, and then Westerners who came into the territory over time, beginning in the 1800s and into the 1900s, 20th century, mainly looking for resources to get wealth. So that's everything from otters to seals, and in more recent time, mining and oil and gas.
Amazing.
We, as a foundation, actually cover the entire state. The history of the foundation was missionaries who came to Alaska in the very early part of the 20th century and accidentally got into banking and ended up owning the largest statewide bank in Alaska and sold it in about 2000 to a large national banking company. And at that time, the family's wealth was primarily donated to what is called now the Rasmussen Foundation. We're actually 65 years old now, but just in recent years, in the last 20 years, became much larger. So we have our mission is Alaska. Our mission is really having everyone who lives in Alaska have a decent quality of life. And we're serious about what we do.
And I'm assuming when I was looking through your website, I'm assuming that you cover, you know, a very large portion of people's lives, not anything specific.
We do. Usually if I talk to colleagues who work in philanthropy, they will say they work in health or they work in the arts and culture or they work in education. And I say we work in Alaska because we really do cover all of those areas and more. There's very little in terms of a part of life that we don't touch in one way or another.
Amazing. And what would you say are some of your key initiatives? I mean, I know alcoholism is one, and we'll talk about it later.
Yes, alcoholism for sure. We've been working on that for many years, and we will be working on it for many years because it's quite an intractable issue to get involved with. Currently, we're very focused on homelessness in our home community of Anchorage, Alaska, but also on the statewide basis. We've, like many other cities in the U.S., especially urban cities in the western part of the U.S., have had an increase over the years in homelessness. And that group of homeless people who are suffering with multiple problems, often including alcoholism, drug abuse, with mental illness in particular, have become more visible in our cities and of more public concern. Mm-hmm. And a very difficult population to help, but we have decided that it's worth our effort to put as many resources as we can into eliminating homelessness in our city. So we've been at that for a few years, and we'll be at it, I'm sure, for many more. That's another one. We're also deeply into arts and culture and have been over the years with different types of interactions with arts organizations, communities, and directly with artists as well.
Amazing. So, you know, Elmer Rasmussen, who's your founder, said, and I quote, "Helping others is an Alaskan tradition," unquote. Help me understand this and maybe give me, for our viewers and listeners, some anecdotes or examples.
Well, Elmer did the sort of the legwork and the physical work setting up the foundation 65 years ago, but it was actually his mother, Jenny, who started it with $3,000 in church bonds at that time. Elmer had gone off to college at Harvard and later was a protege to Arthur Andersen, who is well known in the finance world.
Yep.
And he learned about foundations and trusts and other ways that people could establish a legacy out of their assets. And so that was what they came up with to honor his father at the time. I think because the families came to Alaska as missionaries originally into a small Native village, their original idea in coming here was to be helpful to other people. That was what motivated them to be here in the first place. And that value really carried through in the bank, in the family bank and the family and into the Rasmussen Foundation. So when Elmer said helping others is an Alaska tradition, often what we think about is if you see somebody who's broken down on the side of the road, you don't just keep driving by, you stop. Because often in Alaska with a harsh climate, if someone's in trouble and no one stops to help them, it could be very, very serious and even mean death and a tragedy for that person. So there's a spirit and an expectation when you see somebody who needs assistance to provide it.
Okay. And, you know, you said that there are 700,000 people who live in Alaska, which is double the size of Texas. And yet, when I was speaking to Catherine, the focus was on natives. You said that a lot of work is going in and around Alaska. How do you define natives?
There are traditionally many different native language groups in our state. The top of the world is where people who are called Eskimos by people around the world live. I think it's interesting that term Eskimos. I think everybody knows what an Eskimo is. Everywhere I've been in the world, people are kind of fascinated with that idea. And those are people who live all across the northern regions in Greenland, in Canada, and across the top of the globe. And a little bit south of that, Yupik Eskimos, a different language group, Athabascan Indians in the center of the state, Aleuts, my husband was, the Aleutian chain, and Tlingit Haida and Tsimshian people in the southeast part of the state. And then within those, many different dialects and groups. So it's a very diverse population. It would be like saying European versus saying French or Spanish or Russian or whatever. So it's a diverse Native population, but it's the largest percentage of Native people of any state in the United States.
Okay.
And therefore, Alaska Natives, because of the history, because of the economics, because of just the numbers, maybe play an outsized role in Alaska compared to other people. And there are Native people in every state of the United States, but not to the degree as here in Alaska.
Amazing. So, you know, again, my question that is often I've been fascinated with that, you know, in a state which is such extreme weather conditions, What are some of the challenges of residence in Alaska, and how are these unique as compared to the rest of the US?
Some of the things that are challenges for us that people other places take for granted are, for example, transportation.
Okay.
Most of the communities in our state are not on a road. You can't drive there. You have to fly there or take a boat there. And that would be the large number of individuals in Alaska. So just that, in a place where you have a lot of cold weather, of fog, of all sorts of precipitation, where you have other conditions, smoke, we have volcanoes here. We have every kind of weather condition you can think of. Transportation is often a matter of life and death. And so we have more pilots per capita than anywhere else in the United States. One out of 51 Alaskans can fly a plane, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Not unusual for young people to learn how to become pilots. We also have, just because of distances, the vast cost of transportation and what that does to the cost of food and other things that people need to purchase. A lot of our very rural communities have a subsistence economy where a lot of the food comes from the land and the ocean and the rivers and the tundra, you know, berries, fish, meat, and so on. But for the food that you have to buy that we're traditional to getting, it's extraordinarily inexpensive. So I think what is unique in Alaska is a lot of the poorest areas of the state are also of the highest cost areas of the state.
Wow.
If you went to the lower 48 states, some places in the South, for example, it can be very poor, low economic level, but generally the cost of living is also low, and that's not the case here.
Interesting. So a little while ago, we did speak about alcoholism, and you said that you support and you will continue to support it. Tell me, how are you supporting alcoholism, and why is it such a big challenge in Alaska?
There generally is a large alcohol issue in a lot of the northern areas around the world. Some of the real innovative work has been done in northern Europe, for example, also similarly. So there's some who believe that areas where you have a lot of dark and certain areas of the times of the year when it tends to be dark promotes alcoholism, some type of depression. In Alaska, it's very complicated. Back in before Western people came to Alaska, we had no alcohol here and there was no alcohol problem.
Oh,
so
wow.
It was brought here by visitors.
And there
were people who profited by selling alcohol to native people who were not used to having it and who often had a very, very strong reaction to alcohol. There's some research to show actually a genetic vulnerability to alcoholism. There's some studies done in Southwest Alaska. There's also just a lot of historic trauma in the native population, and also very intertwined with alcohol. So you could say, did alcoholism come first and it caused a lot of these other issues, or are a lot of these other issues causing alcohol? And it's very, very hard to say. But there are a lot of conditions, and clearly the impact on the state is huge, and everything from incarceration, children in need of aid, domestic violence, and then low productivity in the workplace and so on. It's not just a native problem, though. The use of alcohol is pervasive and it's different on other places. It's accepted more to drink more in Alaska than other places.
You know, what you're saying is so fascinating. And as you were talking, I was thinking Russia has a very, very serious problem with alcoholism. And it's probably something to do with the weather.
It could be. I tend to think more it has to do with trauma, mental illness, depression, and self-medicating. That's what I've seen more. But there are many different theories. Regardless of the theory, the impacts are real. And the cost to our state of not addressing this issue are great. And it's such a difficult and complex issue. A lot of people don't want to get into it. So we're looking at, what are the social norms? What is considered normal drinking?
Interesting.
But, if you, for example, have a in some communities, you would never keep the top of the bottle once you opened it. Once you opened it, it's gone. You finish it.
Okay.
So there are things about that. But it's not unusual for people of means who are in very high professional positions, political positions, to publicly drink too much.
Mm.
And in some places in the U.S., you would be fired on the spot if that happened, but not here.
Okay.
There's been a tolerance for behavior that is caused by drinking too much that is different than other places. And that's really what we have to conquer.
Fantastic. And tell me, Brian, how is the Rasmussen Foundation supporting how to tackle alcoholism?
Well, what we decided to do about 10 years ago was draw together some other partners from the state, from private companies, from healthcare companies,
mm-hmm.
Nonprofits, state agencies, and other interested individuals. And we sat in a room for a couple of days and said, if we all got together and put our minds, our hearts, our money together, can we make a difference?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it just too big and it's not worth it? And we decided not only could we had to at least give it a try.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the things we're looking at and measuring success is very difficult. There, a lot of our data is not very good. But we found there were two things that we could measure. One was, what's the age that a kid has their first drink? Because we know if a kid starts drinking early, they're much more likely to have a problem with alcohol later on. So you want to delay, the science says you want to delay the time of that and the age of that first drink. And we are seeing some success on that already. And for adults, it's binge drinking, meaning you don't even have to be an alcoholic or be addicted to alcohol, but you start drinking and you drink too much. Mm. So binging, just going way too far, drinking way too much at one sitting. And that also we're seeing some success about. Different populations are impacted by different kinds of interventions. So young people are very price sensitive. If alcohol is more expensive, their access to it is limited.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the work we're doing is around changing the laws around availability of alcohol and about penalties for alcohol. In the case of young people, we want less in the way of penalties, which is probably surprising, but we find out if the penalties are too high, law enforcement won't enforce them
because
mm-hmm. they don't want to damage a kid for the rest of their life by getting something on their record. But if it's something that they can overcome, like going to education and paying a fine, they're more likely to want to intervene. So we've learned a lot, and we're still learning every day.
I can
imagine. We do ads on television showing kids what's normal, because most kids, not all kids, want to be normal.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to know. Most kids think most other kids drink. They don't. We want other kids to know to be normal is not drinking. It's not drinking. So those kinds of things.
Fantastic. So Dan, one more question for you relating to Alaska, and then I move to a few questions for you personally. This is the age of the millennials and the Gen Zs, and they're changing the whole world. I mean, I always say that, you know, the world that was messed up by my generation hopefully will be corrected or changed by the young people. My question to you is, how are the millennials changing Alaska?
A great question. I don't think we know yet. I think we're seeing how that's coming about. But for one thing, just the way we work is changing. And it's been interesting in this time of a pandemic,
mm-hmm.
the way I think a lot of younger people would like to work with it, which is a more flexible lifestyle that is more balanced between home and work. Maybe we're all getting to test out what that looks like. So I think there's a great desire to not work all the time. However, it's easier to work all the time, of course, if you're at home. Those boundaries of going to work and then coming home are not quite there. So that's why I'm saying I'm not sure what we will see.
Mm-hmm.
I think also that younger people are more tolerant of others in the world. I think a lot of the prejudice that we see and a lot of the inflexibility we see with older people will naturally be taken care of just by the fact that younger people, it seems to me, are used to living in a more diverse world, probably because media is part of it and they can have interactions with people in other places around the globe much more easily than their parents did. I think also that I see a little bit more of a spirit in younger people that I'm really happy to see in just a more of a desire to make a difference in the world, have their work make a difference, not just be a place that you go and get a paycheck. That's so cool. I'm hoping that's a trend that will continue and there'll be more younger people who are going to want to use their intelligence, their money, their workplace to also double bottom line, you know, perhaps get them a salary and take care of them, but also do something good in the world.
Fantastic. So I'm now going to move to the last segment of our conversation. We have, you know, two or three questions for you personally. My first question, Dan, is for someone like you who's reached the top, doing such great work, what are some of the core values you believe in?
I really believe that if you get to a point where you have some level of authority, power, you owe it to others to help them along. So I really believe that there's an obligation to pay it back in all sorts of different ways. One of it, of course, is helping younger people who are trying to establish themselves and be successful, have a dream, help them achieve it, open a door, take a few minutes, pay attention, listen, act like you care to somebody else. Also, I think I feel privileged to have a platform to speak out on issues that are important in the world, and I feel an obligation to use that. I know that we work with a lot of people who are trying to care for seniors, who are trying to care for children, who are trying to make beautiful art or disturbing art or important art for the world to see. And they don't have access to power. They don't have access to policymakers necessarily in the same way that I do. So using that voice carefully, but for good, and speaking out when there's injustice, and people look to you for what they should think or how they should feel, or even just pointing out that something has happened that others should pay attention to. I feel there's an obligation that goes along with having that access to an audience, to power, to a voice, because many people just don't have a way to have their voice be heard. So that's key for me. And then I do believe, and this goes back to Elmer Rasmussen and what you said, is people need a hand up and a way to be successful in whatever that means for them. And it doesn't mean giving, giving, giving all the time. It means helping. It's that helping word where if you can provide somebody with an opportunity, tools, equity, so they have the same chance to achieve their dreams, support their families, support themselves, contribute to the world, to try and if you have the capacity to do that, to be a part of their individual solution.
Fascinating. So I have time for two more questions for you. My next question is, from where you stand today, as you look at life, what does success mean to Diane?
Oh, I feel like it's very far away. What success?
Okay.
In the context of Rasmussen Foundation, I work with a family that has the name Rasmussen. And I hope that what I've done is through my work and working with really great people, finding great people to work with, have that name be admired and have that name be respected in our place. And I believe that's true. I think it was true before I got here, and I want it to be true when I leave here, and I'm hoping that's true, and maybe the good work of that family is more notable now or more noticeable now to other people.
Fantastic.
And then I think just looking at the condition of Alaska and certain parts, are we a place where the arts thrive more than they did 20 years ago? Are we a place where there's more access to healthcare than 20 years ago? Have we put Alaska on the map as far as philanthropy across the United States and the world, where others want to invest in our solutions? Because we're very creative people. We have a lot of brilliant practitioners in the state. Have we given them a national platform? Those are the kinds of things I look at.
Fantastic.
Success. I think Alaska's success is our success, really.
Wonderful. And my last question to you, Diane, and you know, from our conversation and what I read about you, you keep been giving back a lot to the land that you live on. Who or what inspires you to keep pushing yourself so much?
Well, I first go to my mom, who's 87. She just turned 88 years old this week. Wow. She lives in New York, where I grew up, all by herself. She is within a mile or two of the center of the pandemic in the United States. So I think some of those early images we saw were refrigerator trucks parked in hospital parking lots. That's where she lives. And it's been rough for somebody like her, but she's incredibly resilient, and she's always been that way. She was a divorced mother of three kids at a time when I knew no other kid who had divorced parents. And a lot of families fall apart when that happened, but she somehow found it within her to keep that family going so my brothers and me could have a good life. And of course, we had other family members who helped us and friends and so on. But certainly she was the center of that. It wasn't easy. And it meant she had to give up some of her own dreams so that we could do what we ended up doing. So that would be first. And then, you know, I really look at people who have around the world who have committed their lives to social justice.
Mm-hmm.
Because as a Jewish person whose roots are in, who had family, many of whom did not escape Europe during World War II, I know that, it's the rare person who puts themselves at risk to save other people or to do something good for other people. And obviously, a few of my relatives got out of there, and that's why I'm here today. And I never forget that that's the case. So I think you just, when you have that background and it becomes just part of who you are. So that's certainly an inspiration of those very brave people who have, put their own lives at risk to do something good for others.
Fantastic. Diane, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you for this amazing journey you've taken me through on the Rasmussen Foundation in Alaska.
Pleasure has been mine, absolutely. The pleasure has been mine, absolutely.
Thank you again.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. Bye. Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.